You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Our cases have been researched using open source and archive materials. It deals with true crimes and real people. Each episode is produced with the utmost respect to the victims, their families, and loved ones. It was a cold winter's night in Stockholm in February 1986. A 59-year-old man was walking home with his wife after seeing a movie at the Grand Theater Cinema. It was after 11 p.m. and they were making their way to the metro station to go home. A figure stepped out of the shadows, pulled out a revolver, and shot the man, point blank in his back. Then, he fired another shot, grazing the woman's back as she turned away. With the echo of the gunshot still ringing in the street, the assailant ran away, up the stairs on Tunnel Gatan. He stopped briefly at the top of the steps, looked back at his victim, then disappeared into the night. A taxi driver saw the incident and immediately radioed emergency services. Two young women ran closer to help the man who was bleeding in the snow. As they approached the scene, they recognized the man fighting for his life. The shooting victim was no ordinary man. He was the Prime Minister of Sweden. Olof Palme was a world leader at the height of the Cold War, who was not afraid to speak his mind. Although he had many political friends, he also had enemies in the United States, South Africa, Chile, and Yugoslavia, just to mention a few. Shockwaves rippled through Sweden as the news of his murder broke in the early morning hours. It shook the Swedish nation to its core. How could their leader be gunned down in his hometown in plain sight? To many people, the 28th of February, 1986, was the day Sweden lost her innocence. And 30 years later, the murder of the Prime Minister remains unsolved. More than 130 people have claimed responsibility for the assassination, but with so many secret agencies at play, will authorities ever know for sure who ordered the hit on Olof Palme? Sven Olof Joachim Palme was the son of Gunnar and Elizabeth Palme. He was born on the 27th of January, 1927, in Stockholm. He was the youngest of three children. His brother was Klaus and his sister, Catherine. Through his father's family, Olof could trace his lineage back to King Frederick I of Denmark and Norway. His mother was Baltic German, and she arrived in Sweden as a refugee from Russia in 1915. Olof's father died when he was 6 years old, and Elizabeth raised the children alone. He was a sickly child and received most of his education from tutors at his home. He was quick to pick up languages, and in addition to his native tongue of Swedish, he could speak English and German fluently from a young age. He attended the exclusive boarding school, Sigtuna School of Liberal Arts, as a teenager, and passed the university entrance exam with ease. In 1945, he was called to do his compulsory military service and swiftly rose to the rank of captain in the artillery. When he left the army in 1947, he enrolled to study at the University of Stockholm. A scholarship took him to the U.S. at Kenyon College, a small liberal arts school in Ohio. He received his Bachelor of Arts degree in only 1 year and became part of the political scene on campus. He wrote his honors thesis about the United Auto Workers Union. After his studies, he took some time off and hitchhiked through the USA and Mexico. In America, he visited no less than 34 states. He would later remark that America made him a socialist. The comment confused many people, but it was not actually meant as an insult. Olof Palme was inspired by the social structure in post-war America. The obvious divide between classes intrigued him, and he found it unjust that black people had to struggle for equality. He was determined to speak out against injustice for the rest of his career. When he returned to Stockholm in 1949, Palma enrolled in the university once more, this time to study law. As a student just starting out in politics, he traveled through Europe extensively and observed the various ways in which countries were governed. He openly opposed communism and took a personal stand against it. When he visited what was then Czechoslovakia in 1948, he met a medical student called Jelena Renarova, who was in danger of being persecuted by her government. He married her in Prague so she could have permission to leave her native country. When she left Czechoslovakia, Jelena initially joined her brother, who lived in Paris, and continued her studies there. But when she heard that Sweden offered better options for foreign students, she asked Olof Palme for his help again. No questions asked. He stepped in and arranged for her to complete her studies at the University of Uppsala. Once Jelena had completed her education and had settled in Sweden, they divorced. Palme married for a second time in June 1956. This time, his marriage was not a political statement. He had found his life partner. Baroness Lisbeth Beck-Friss was an esteemed psychologist in Stockholm, and she supported her husband's ideals. They had three sons together, Joachim, Martin, and Matthias. He embodied the modern family man of the 60s, who would be successful in his career while making time to spend with his wife and children. He was often seen going for walks or playing with his sons, like any other father did. Even when the Palma boys were grown up, they loved spending time with their parents. Palma joined the Swedish Social Democratic Party and fit right in. He rose to become the speechwriter and political advisor to Prime Minister Tage Erlander, who served for more than 20 years. In 1965, Palma was ready to move out of the wings as he was appointed as Minister of Transport and Communication. He later became Minister of Education and implemented Marxist ideology as part of the curriculum in Swedish schools. During this time, he caused a stir when he marched alongside the North Vietnam ambassador to the Soviet Union, Nguyen Tho Chan, at a protest in Stockholm opposing U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War. He would later go on to call U.S. bombings of the country crimes against humanity. Because of this, diplomatic relations with America were not good. Nixon ousted Sweden's diplomatic service from the U.S. and withdrew American ambassador to Stockholm. Nixon was even quoted at the time referring to Palma as that Swedish asshole. When Tage Erlander stepped down as prime minister in 1968, Olof Palme was elected to be the new head of the Social Democratic Party, which made him the new prime minister. At 42 years old, he was the youngest head of state in all of Europe. And as prime minister, Olof Palme had a way to provoke emotions. People either loved him or they hated him. It was impossible to feel indifferent towards him. Forthright and outspoken, he criticized European communist regimes. He campaigned against nuclear weapons. And at a time when the world hated leaders like Fidel Castro and Yasser Arafat, he kept close relations with them, listening to what they had to say. He was a feminist and placed great importance on gender equality. One of his most famous speeches was titled The Emancipation of Man, which he delivered at the Women's National Democratic Club on June 8, 1970. In this speech, he said that policies should be put in place to support families with small children. It should not be expected of the mother to give up her career while all pressure to provide a living should fall on the father. And instead, fathers should have a more active role in the household. He encouraged a culture where fathers could be as involved in child-rearing as mothers, and women have equal opportunities in the workplace once they have had their children. Palme was also ahead of his time with regards to environmental issues, pushing the importance of nuclear power as a source of energy. Despite his many reforms and ideals, his reign would not last. In 1976, the Social Democratic Party was voted out for the first time in 44 years, and Olof Palme left office. He remained in politics as leader of the opposition. In 1980, the United Nations appointed him as the mediator in the Iran-Iraq War. 6 years after he was voted out, Palme was voted back in. He remained the country's prime minister until his death in 1986. Palme had a true passion for international politics. But at the heart of it all, he was a humanitarian who believed in fair treatment of all mankind. He called the Franco regime in Spain Satan's murderers. He shone a spotlight on apartheid and supported economic sanctions against South Africa. The African National Congress, or ANC, and Palestinian Liberation Organization, or PLO, received ongoing financial support from Sweden thanks to Palma. He was neither a capitalist nor a communist. To Palma, there should have been what he referred to as a third way, a balance between American and Soviet economic philosophies. This put him out of favor with the U.S. once again, as he was seen to be a sympathizer of Soviet Russia. Olof Palme had been called a revolutionary reformist who was both loved and despised. His main goal was to create a booming welfare state in Sweden that promoted an ethical and humanitarian foreign policy. Although Sweden was technically neutral during the Cold War, Palme was often accused by his own country as well as others to have been too lenient on the Soviet Union. A pressing issue was the fact that Soviet submarines breached sovereignty with their presence in Swedish waters. In 1981, the Soviet submarine U-137 hit a rock near a Swedish naval base in Karlskrona. The Russians claimed that navigation equipment was faulty, and they unintentionally found themselves in Swedish water. When a nuclear weapon was found on board, it sparked an outrage. Was Sweden in danger of being attacked by the Soviet Union? Turns out, it was the West that was behind the submarine invasion all the time. It was done in a bid to ruin Palma's reputation and make him appear weak. It was part of a psychological warfare operation in an attempt to provoke violent retaliation from the Swedes. Palma was the only one who was prepared to open communication with Russia, and the West did not like this one bit. In December 1985, similar issues brought a lot of conflict with Palme and his military commanders. He was accused of being pro-Soviet, and that he did not put Sweden's safety first. Palme announced that he was planning to visit the Soviet Union in the spring of the following year, as he was very much pro-nuclear disarmament. By the end of February 1986, Palme was preparing for his trip to Moscow. On Friday the 28th, it was a usual upbeat Friday atmosphere at Rosenbad, the seat of the Swedish government. During the day, Lisbeth was at work. She was overheard that afternoon talking about seeing a film. She called her 23-year-old son Martin around 5 p.m. and then went home. Palme arrived home at 6:30, and Lisbeth suggested they join Martin and his girlfriend to see The Mozart Brothers, an art house Swedish comedy by Susan Austin. He talked to Martin on the phone around 7 p.m. Martin and his girlfriend had already bought their tickets, as it was a popular film. Only around 8 p.m. did Olof and Lisbeth Palme decide to go and let their son know that they would meet him at the cinemas. They left home at 8:40, and as usual, there were no bodyguards. Stockholm was considered to be one of the safest cities in the world at the time. Besides, Palme often sent his bodyguards away, as he wanted to live a normal life in the city he was born and raised, a city he believed to be safe. A neighbor saw the Palmas leave as she arrived home. The neighbor recalled seeing a man who behaved strangely. He walked behind the Palmas and stopped at the corner when they went into the metro station. The neighbor could see that the man was speaking on a walkie-talkie and found it weird. More witnesses came forward and said that they saw other people with walkie-talkies in central Stockholm that night. One man was seen on the platform at the metro station near the Palmas' home. The train driver noticed two men following the Palmas onto the train. A woman saw a police officer standing outside of his official vehicle, speaking on a walkie-talkie as he watched the Palmas. She remembered it as she thought it was strange that he did not use the radio in his car. The Grand Theater Cinema was halfway between two stations, and the Palmas went to the farther stop of Rådmansgatan. The train driver noted that the two men who had followed them onto the train also got off the train at the same station. The ticket desk attendant at the metro station saw another man following the Palmas out of the station onto the street. Olof and Lisbeth met Martin and his girlfriend at the movies and enjoyed the feature that started at 9. Afterwards, they had a short conversation outside of the building, then went their separate ways around 11:15 p.m. Lisbeth did some window shopping along the way, looking at the display in the windows of an interior design store. Then they carried on, walking arm in arm with Olaf on the inside and Lisbeth curbside. When they reached the corner of Sveafagen and Tanogatan, Lisbeth became aware of a man approaching them from behind. She heard the first shot and instinctively turned away as the second one went off. Her husband of 30 years dropped to the ground and lost consciousness within a minute or two. The gunman ran away, up the 89 steps on Tanogatan. Lisbeth saw him stop for a second to look at them before he turned and disappeared. A witness chased after him, but ultimately lost him. The immediate response to the shooting was chaotic, and it really set the tone for the first hours and days of the investigation. The taxi driver called emergency 90000, but his call was misdirected. The taxi switchboard operator then called police to give them the message. A second taxi driver, who heard the conversation on his comms, saw a police vehicle close by, so he jumped out of his taxi and flagged them down. Two women saw the shooting and rushed to Olaf Palma's aid. One of the women, Anna Haga, was a nursing student, and she tried to give him CPR, but it was already too late. As luck would have it, an ambulance happened to pass by the scene at that moment. There was already a small crowd, and one of the bystanders called the ambulance to come back. Granted, all of this happened within 5 minutes of the shooting. At that moment, most of the people at the scene were unaware that the victim was their prime minister. Olaf Palma was carried into the ambulance, and his wife, Lisbeth, refused to leave his side. His identity was only revealed once he was inside the ambulance. The police superintendent in charge of the scene informed dispatch that the prime minister had been shot. In a well-publicized phone call, when hearing that the prime minister had been shot, the operator can be heard saying with disbelief, "You're kidding." Olaf Palma arrived at Sabbatsburg Hospital just after midnight at 12:06, March 1st, 1986, and was announced dead on arrival. At a quarter to one, Deputy Prime Minister Ingvar Carlsson arrived at Rosenbad to take charge. At 10 minutes past one, the first radio broadcast about the murder was made. Olaf Palma's funeral was held 2 weeks after he was killed. It was a touching ceremony with 9 short eulogies. Lisbeth and their sons walked behind the white coffin, adorned with red roses. Newly appointed Prime Minister Ingvar Carlsson said that Olaf Palma could be described as a free and powerful bird, killed in full flight. The funeral procession was a slow and somber march through the streets of Stockholm. As dusk fell onto the city where Olaf Palma was born and where he had died, the nation mourned the loss of a great leader. Even people who didn't support his political views turned up to pay their respects. The whole country came to a standstill. The kind of violence that ended Palma's life in their beloved city was an unforgivable act. The police had their job cut out for them. People needed answers. Who killed their prime minister? From the very beginning of the investigation, many mistakes were made. When law enforcement learned that the victim was Olaf Palma, there was a sense of panic, and normal procedure went out the window. To give some perspective of how unusual the circumstances were, no leader of Sweden had been killed since King Gustav III in 1792. That's almost 200 years before Palma was gunned down. Also, no other European head of state had been murdered since World War II. The chief of police in Stockholm, Hans Holmér, was placed in charge of the investigation in an effort to ensure the public that they intended to use the best resources for the job. However, although Holmér was great at his job as the head of police, he was not an investigator. He had never investigated a murder in his life. Basic mistakes were made. The crime scene was not cordoned off properly. It took police close to 2 hours to set up roadblocks to monitor movement in and out of the city center. And by that time, the assailant was long gone. Two witnesses saw a man running up the stairs of Tanogatan and disappeared from their sight in David Bagaris Street. As time went by, more and more witnesses came forward. In the end, 25 witnesses in total claimed to have seen the assassination. The conclusion of all the testimonies was that the assailant was a dark-haired man, just over 6 foot, or almost 2 meters tall, with a dark jacket. Some witnesses say that he had a limp, or that his getaway was clumsy. Others said he ran away swiftly and quickly, disappearing into the night. A composite sketch of the assassin was drawn up, but witnesses couldn't agree if it was an accurate portrayal or not. In the end, the only thing they knew for sure was that they had no idea what the gunman looked like. Everybody did agree on the escape route, however. Multiple witnesses also came forward and told police about the network of men with walkie-talkies who had kept surveillance on the Palmas on the night the Prime Minister was killed. Two Finnish women reported seeing a Finnish-speaking man, whom they knew, as he went to their gym, standing at the entrance of a store about 300 yards from where Palma was killed. One of the women went up to him, spoke to him in Finnish, but he didn't reply. According to the witness, during the awkward silence, she heard the crackling sound of a walkie-talkie coming from the man's jacket, and someone at the other end saying, "They're coming now." Then the man took out a walkie-talkie and said, "I've been spotted. What should I do?" To which the person replied, "Complete the mission." According to the witness, the man then ran away in the direction where Palma was shot. The woman felt uncomfortable and left. They heard a loud bang and assumed a car had backfired. It was only when they heard about the assassination that they thought their information could be relevant to law enforcement. Police followed up, went to the gym in Upplands-Väsby, but could never find the man matching the witness's description. Another dead end. Many conspiracy theories emerged that pointed fingers at members of the police force, but it was dismissed as rumors. The witnesses later told the media that after they reported what they had seen, they received threatening calls. The media took statements from all the witnesses, but police never spoke to all of them. Inside the police force was the Petty Crimes Unit, known as the Baseball League. Most members of the squad were affiliated with extreme right-wing elements. Photos exist of senior members doing the Hitler salute. The founder of the Baseball League was chief of police himself, Hans Holmér. Although Holmér was officially a social democrat, he was known to associate with right-wing extremists within the police force. What cast more suspicion onto police was the fact that one of the members of the Baseball League happened to work in communications on the night of Palma's murders. The first emergency calls about shots being fired were cut off. Once it could not be contained any longer, he only broadcasted the shooting on one frequency, reaching only a limited number of emergency vehicles. Also, contrary to protocol, he did not use the alert level 1 for urgent cases. Instead, he opted for level 3, a low priority level. So, only a handful of responders received the alert that there was an incident, and it was not that serious. Chief Investigator Hans Olvebro refused to follow up on the theory that Palma's killing was a plot that had originated in the police force. He made it clear to the media that he would not allocate any resources to explore that accusation. Investigators wondered how a well-orchestrated plot could have been executed if the Palma's decision to go to the movies on that Friday night was made on the spur of the moment. They searched the Palma home, as well as Martin's apartment, for bugging devices on the phones or around the home, but could not find anything. Lisbeth said that she recalled two men acting suspiciously outside their home 3 weeks before the killings, but that was near impossible to verify. Looking at forensic evidence, they found that the Prime Minister was shot in the back at close range. The first bullet traveled through his trachea and esophagus and damaged a main artery in the sternum before exiting his body. The second shot missed Olaf, but hit Lisbeth. It only scraped her back as she turned away, causing a superficial wound. The bullets were fired from a revolver, so no bullet casings would have ejected. Both bullets were recovered by witnesses at the scene, and not by police officers. Ballistic experts concluded that the gun that had fired the bullets was most likely a Smith & Wesson 357 Magnum. The copper-tipped lead bullets were not common in Sweden at all. It didn't match any of the 500 to 600 bullets in the police reference collection. This kind of bullet was designed to pierce metal, or even a bulletproof vest. It was not the average bullet, and would have been difficult, if possible at all, to source in Sweden. There was tremendous pressure on investigators. The public needed answers. Police had to name a suspect. It was unacceptable that someone could simply walk up to the prime minister, kill him, and run away. Despite witness statements of many people following the Palmas, investigators felt strongly that the killing was the work of a lone assassin, without the backing of a bigger cause. The murder was simply too risky and the getaway too sloppy for a professional organization. The first suspect they looked at was a man by the name of Victor Gunnarsson. He was a right-wing extremist who was very outspoken against Palma. He grew up in southern Sweden and was involved in politics from a young age. Witnesses placed him at a cafe in Stockholm called Mansari on the night of Palma's murder. He was overheard making anti-Palma remarks, and before he left, he gave two women a business card. Witnesses claimed to have seen him on Tunnelgatan after the shooting and also outside Grand Theater Cinemas earlier that night. A week after Palma's assassination, Gunnarsson was taken in for questioning. He was labeled the 33-year-old by the media. His friends described him as kind and harmless. What made him even more suspicious was the presence of gun residue on his jacket. He was arrested in April 1986, but due to a lack of evidence, he was released later the same month. In May, detectives were satisfied that he was not the person they were looking for, and the investigation against him was closed. In December 1993, less than a decade after Palma's death, Gunnarsson's body was found almost naked, a fair distance away from his apartment in Salisbury, North Carolina. His death was the result of a love triangle gone wrong, and his murderer was caught and convicted. Gunnarsson always maintained his innocence in the Palma murder. A year after the prime minister was shot, another name kept coming up on police radar. Christer Pettersson. He was a known criminal and drug user who had been convicted of manslaughter when he was a teenager. He was eventually arrested 3 years after Olof Palme's murder, after he was picked out of a video lineup by Lisbeth Palme. Another witness, who saw the incident from a parked car, also identified Pettersson as the assailant. Pettersson was tried and convicted for Palme's murder, but later acquitted on appeal. His appeal succeeded for three reasons. Firstly, because the murder weapon was never found. Secondly, because prosecution never really managed to establish a clear motive. And lastly, there was a big question mark over how police arranged the video lineup in which Pettersson was identified. The identification evidence was ruled to be uncertain. In the 1990s, new evidence surfaced that pointed to Pettersson as the gunman yet again. This included a confession by Pettersson himself. One of his friends told police that Pettersson said that he was guilty, but that they would never be able to prove it as the weapon was gone. However, most of the evidence was conversations overheard or secondhand retellings, and it wasn't enough to charge Pettersson for the murder again. Years later, after Pettersson's death, some of his associates came forward and said that he had confessed the murder to them, but that it was all a big blunder. In fact, it was a case of mistaken identity. On that February night in 1986, he had intended to shoot Sivgard Sedergren, a drug dealer who, as fate would have it, bore a strong resemblance to Olof Palme. Sivgard Sedergren was also known to go for late-night walks in the city. Pettersson wanted to kill him after a drug deal gone bad. It was revealed in a documentary that police were staking out the area surrounding the Grand Theater Cinema on the night of Palma's murder because of local drug activity. But they had ceased the observation 45 minutes before Palma's shooting. The documentary was criticized for omitting contradictory evidence and also fabricating statements. Some people believed that Pettersson was used as a scapegoat. It was easier to believe that a lone gunman with substance abuse problems was behind it than a larger organization, because that in turn would mean that the whole of Sweden was under threat. To this day, Pettersson remains the strongest suspect in the case. Most people think he was the one who pulled the trigger, but he died in September 2004 due to a cerebral hemorrhage caused by an epileptic fit. A larger conspiracy attributed Palma's death to the Kurdish organization PKK. In the mid-1980s, multiple PKK defectors who had sought refuge in Sweden were murdered. Because of that, Palma's government declared the organization a terrorist unit. Many PKK members were deported from Sweden after this ruling. There was evidence that the organization had acquired a handgun in the weeks before the murder, so police believed that there was a chance they wanted revenge against Palma. In January 1987, no less than 22 people associated with the PKK were taken in for questioning, but they were all released within a couple of hours. Turkish newspapers claimed that the PKK had admitted to the murder. The PKK said in 1998 that the allegations were made as part of a propaganda plot by the Turkish government to discredit their organization. In 1995, German journalist Klaus-Dieter Knapp said in an article in the newspaper Die Zeit that right-wing extremist police officers in Sweden were responsible for Palma's death. This report states that two witnesses were able to identify the murderer, but police never investigated this lead. In the late 1990s, another possibility came to light. In South Africa, the first free and fair elections were held in 1994, which meant the end of apartheid. Nelson Mandela, as leader of the ANC, became president. For the first time in the country's political history, they did not have a minority rule. The tables had turned, and much like the Nuremberg trials after the Second World War, South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission was appointed to smoke out the crimes of the previous government. Information about South African espionage was declassified. In the 1970s, the South African National Party, which was the ruling party that invented apartheid, enjoyed support from the far-right movements in Europe and other countries around the world. Z-Squad Incorporated was an intelligence unit that was tasked with eliminating possible opposers of the apartheid government in Europe. The suspected leader of Z-Squad was South African weapons dealer and spy Dirk Stoffberg. He was taken in for questioning at Heathrow Airport in the year following Olaf Palme's murder. In his possession was a hit list with names of members of the ANC and their sympathizers living in Europe. But a couple of years later, in the early 1990s, Stoffberg died in a motor vehicle accident under suspicious circumstances and therefore could not be questioned any further. Colonel Eugene de Kock, a former police officer, confessed to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that Palma was eliminated by the apartheid government because he opposed their ideals and gave financial support to the ANC. Palma very strongly opposed apartheid, and he was not afraid to speak his mind. A week before his death, he made the keynote speech to the Swedish People's Parliament against apartheid in Stockholm. He made a very strong statement saying that apartheid should not be reformed. It should be abolished. De Kock pointed the finger to former South African spy Craig Williamson for orchestrating the murder. A Swedish intermediary, who lived in Cyprus, was said to have worked for Williamson, helping him to find an assassin in Sweden. The intermediary was a man by the name of Bertil Wieden. Wieden supported the far-right wing in Sweden, and he was an informer for Swedish intelligence, SAPO. In the 1970s, Wieden organized mercenaries to assist the minority governments of Rhodesia and South Africa with guerrilla attacks in Angola and Mozambique. This is when he met South African spy Craig Williamson, leader of Longreach, an operation that targeted and eliminated opponents of apartheid, both in South Africa and abroad. Bertil Wieden became instrumental in making connections between apartheid South Africans and far-right circles in Sweden. In October 1996, a month after the information of the confessions in South Africa surfaced, Swedish police went there to follow up. They interviewed Eugene de Kock and Craig Williamson, but were unable to substantiate anything. When investigators left South Africa, they told the press that they were satisfied. After the visit, the Swedish police stopped their investigation into the South Africans, concluding that they were not behind the hit on the Prime Minister. However, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission concluded that the perpetrators in the killing of Olaf Palme were, quote, South African agents in collaboration with Swedish henchmen, end quote. They also stated that the man behind it all was Craig Williamson. Tommy Lindström, who was head of Swedish CID at the time of Palme's murder, was also convinced that the apartheid government of South Africa was responsible. According to Lindström, their motive was to stop payments to the ANC from the Soviet Union that was paid into a Swiss account by the middleman, the Swedish government. In April 2001, the theory that the Kurdish PKK was responsible resurfaced. Swedish investigators acted on a tip and went to Turkey to interview PKK leader Abdullah Öcalan. Following up on the allegations that a Kurdish dissident group led by Öcalan's ex-wife was responsible for Palmer's death. The investigators left without any new information. The tip was given to them by none other than Bertil Whedon. People who believe that South African spies were responsible for Palmer's murder feel that Whedon tipped off authorities about the PKK to divert the attention away from South Africa just as things were heating up for them in the investigation. Whedon denies any involvement in Palmer's murder to this day. Another international theory was that Palmer had died because of his stance on the situation in Chile. Palmer had given asylum to leftist Chileans after the 1973 coup that overthrew Salvador Allende. The man behind the assassination of Palmer here is said to be Roberto Dieme. Dieme was a Chilean fascist who headed the most militant wing of Patria y Libertad, a far-right organization. Then an American former agent confessed to the killing, saying he had acted on behalf of Chile. Many years after the murder, a witness who attended the same film as the Palmas did that night claimed to have seen the American agent that night at the cinema. Over the years, many books have been written and many documentaries have been made, and every one of them has a different theory about who killed Olof Palme. In 2005, Jan Bondesson published a book called Blood on the Snow, The Killing of Olof Palme, that points out the links between Palme's murder and arms trades to India. Palme had secured a multi-billion dollar arms deal for the Swedish company Bofors to supply the Indian army with artillery. However, Bofors went behind his back to secure the deal by bribing Indian government officials using a British connection. On the morning of his murder, Olof Palme met with the Iraqi ambassador, Mohammed Saeed al-Sagaf, who told him about Bofors' dealings. Palme was furious. According to Bondesson's research, Palme was killed so he wouldn't expose the corruption. If Palme had blown the whistle, they risked losing the multi-billion dollar deal. According to Bondesson, MI6 intelligence supplied information to the Swedish police, but it was suppressed. War material inspector Carl Fredrik Algernon agreed to testify in the Bofors investigation. But before he could do so, he allegedly took his own life by jumping in front of a metro train in January 1987. And yet, another plot surfaced involving the CIA and Italian Masonic Lodge Propaganda 2, or P2. A telegram was discovered from Grand Master of the organization, Lucio Gelli, to American Republic Representative Philip Guarino. Guarino was one of the members of George Bush Sr.'s inner circle. The telegram that was sent 3 days before Palma's murder said, "Tell our friend that the Swedish tree will be felled." According to former CIA agents Ibrahim Razin and Richard Brennecke, Palmer knew too much about illegal international weapons trade in connection with the Iran-Iraq war. The CIA denied any involvement in the alleged plot. Philip Guarino denied any knowledge of the telegram. Swedish police dismissed the claims and called Razin an international scammer. Journalist Katz Falk investigated arms smuggling and international governments' roles in illegal arms trade. But before she could publish her work, she drowned in Hamar by Haman. Mysteriously, the friend she was swimming with also drowned. Swedish investigators felt that the key to Palma's murder was closer to home. Journalist Thomas Pedersen felt the same way, and he published a series of articles titled The Unlikely Assassin, based on a long-running investigation into the Palma murder. He claimed that it was a man called Stig Engström who had killed Olof Palme. He was known as the Scandia Man because he worked at the Scandia Insurance Company. He was the first eyewitness to arrive at the scene. Engström did not like Palme and what he stood for, so the theory is that he chanced upon Olof and Lisbeth as they walked home and saw an opportunity to eliminate a prime minister whom he despised. Engström fitted descriptions of the man who fled the scene. And although he, as self-proclaimed witness, claimed to have been at the scene the whole time, nobody could recall seeing him immediately after the shooting. The theory is that he ran away after the shooting, then made his way back to the scene, the last place where anyone would suspect the murderer to have been. He played the role of a distraught witness. Through the years, police found him to be an inconsistent and unreliable witness and considered him as a person of interest. Engstrom was quite vocal in the media as he told his version of events of that night. He also criticized police openly. Engstrom can no longer answer to the allegations, though, because he took his own life in 2000. In 2006, following a tip-off, police divers found a gun in a lake in central Sweden. Bullets fired by this gun during the robbery of a post office matched bullets found at the Palma crime scene. However, the gun was rusted and had been damaged after being in water for years. And there was not any evidence confirming that the bullets that killed Olof Palme were fired from that particular weapon. So many people connected with this case have died. At the bottom of every rabbit hole, you'll find yet another life that was lost. Sure, everyone died in unrelated incidents. Victor Gunnarsson was killed by his partner's jealous ex. Dirk Stoffberg died in a suspicious car accident. Stig Engstrom took his own life. One can't help but wonder if the one thing they all had in common, suspicion in the murder of Olof Palme, had something to do with their deaths. It has been more than 30 years since Olof Palme's assassination, and over the years, more than 130 people have confessed to the murder. And still, the case has not been solved. The late Stig Larsson was obsessed with the Palme case. If his name rings a bell, he was the author of the Millennium series, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, Girl Who Played with Fire, and The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest. Journalist and author Jan Stocksla was granted access to Larsson's archive, an extensive and well-indexed resource. Boxes full of information filled a storage space. It took Stocksla years to work his way through all of Larsson's research, but he is confident that within the research lies an answer. South Africans contracted Bertil Wieden, who tasked Swedish right-wing extremists. The actual gunman, according to Larsson's research and Stocksla's interpretation, was a man called Jacob Thiedelin. Larsson and Stocksla concluded that the planning and setup of the murder was professional, most likely done by people with experience in espionage, but the execution of the actual murder was poorly done. Thiedelin, who still lives in Stockholm, has been recorded spitting on Palme's grave, saying that the former prime minister was a Soviet spy. The book exploring this theory in English will be released later this year. Look out for The Man Who Played with Fire, Stig Larsson's Lost Files, and The Hunt for an Assassin. The Palme family established the Olof Palme Memorial Fund for International Understanding and Common Security. This is a yearly grant to further human rights and democracy. Lisbeth Palme died in 2018, sadly, never seeing her husband's murderer brought to justice. To the end, she still believed that Christer Pettersson was the man that she saw. The part of Tunnel Gatan where Olof Palme spent his last moments alive has been renamed Olof Palme's Gata. There is a memorial plaque which serves as a constant reminder of the day that changed Sweden forever, and the fact that whoever killed Olof Palme got away with murder. If you'd like to read more about this case, have a look at the resources used for this episode in the show notes. Also, visit and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/evidencelockerpodcast to see more about today's case. If you like our podcast, please subscribe in Apple Podcast or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. We would also appreciate it if you could review the episodes, as it gives us some street cred in the world of podcasting. This was The Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.